Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Is the coronavirus making a comeback in Massachusetts? There were nearly 500 new cases of COVID-19 confirmed in the state over the weekend, and the percentage of positive tests, one of the state's key measures, has ticked upward in the last several days after holding steady earlier this month. Now, in just a minute, we're going to take your questions about the coronavirus with two local doctors. You call. We do everything we can to answer your questions. Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But first, let's take a look at the numbers. With us to do that is WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thank you, Tiziana. I miss you.
I miss you, too. It's great to have you back on, although I have mixed feelings about that because we're having you back on because we have this word up coming up with our coronavirus yes. numbers. And I don't like that word when it comes to the coronavirus. No. But we said if the numbers went up, we would talk about it. We would pay attention. So how much up are they and how concerned should we be?
Well, I think maybe rather than concerned, vigilant is more the appropriate word at this point. You know, the state is keeping a very close eye on those numbers, and you can see the state's willingness to act to keep them down in those strict new travel regulations that take effect this Saturday. I'd say the bottom line right now is that our numbers are still nice and low, especially compared to this spring here and to the poor other parts of the country where there are surges right now. We're averaging somewhere between 200 or closer to 300 reported new confirmed and probable cases a day.
So, Carrie, I get it that that is much better than it was in the spring, but also not the bar we want to have long term. Yeah. And that above 200 number is more than it was for a while, right?
It's a bit more. I mean, in late June, early July, the total new cases were tending to hover closer to 230 or 240 a day. More recently, we're seeing closer to 270, 280 a day. But Tiziana, to put that in perspective, at our peak in mid to late April, we were seeing more like 2,200 new cases a day, so nearly 10 times as much. And if you want the visual on this, there are some really beautiful graphs of COVID in Massachusetts at WBUR.org. And to me, what they mostly look like is a giant mountain that plateaued in late April, early May, and then it heads downward all through May. And since June, it's been almost entirely flat, except for just maybe a bit of a gentle rise in mid-July. So it's like we're not even foothills. We're kind of on a plain with just a tiny bit of rise.
So we can continue to watch those numbers. WBUR does it every day, and we always have charts available. This rise, is it concentrated in certain places? I mean, do we know what's behind it?
Well, somewhat. You know, we are solidly in phase three of the reopening. Restaurants are allowing indoor dining, museums and gyms and movie theaters are open. But Governor Baker is pointing to a lack of adherence to the guidelines rather than reopening itself. And, you know, we have been hearing about some concerning clusters of cases, including there was a party in Chatham in early July that actually led several Cape Cod restaurants to shut down because workers were infected. The news today is that 8 lifeguards in Falmouth tested positive, apparently after a party they attended. And Bay State Medical Center in Springfield is reporting an outbreak of 36 people, 23 of them employees, 13 of them patients. And they're saying it stemmed from an employee's trip to a hotspot. And speaking of hotspots, by the way, we've got more. Governor Baker has added Agawam, Brockton, Methuen, Randolph, Revere, Springfield, Taunton, and Worcester to the list of places where there will be extra free testing because their positive test rates are on the high side. They're averaging 2.3% compared to the latest state average, which is 1.9%.
So it seems like a really good time to remember the basics, right? And go back to basics, yep. Masks, hand washing, social distancing. It is encouraging that the word gentle rise, I'll go back to the term you used, can be encouraging. I did read that we have some concerns from the medical community about whether or not we're behind this curve or what we should do about it.
Yes, and I think those concerns are very worth listening to, especially when they're coming from the president of the Mass Medical Society. Here's Dr. David Rossman. He says he's urging the state to consider slowing the reopening in view of these latest numbers.
We don't know for sure that the cases are truly increasing or that it is statistically important. And that, I think, is why I use the word consider, because we don't know for sure where we are. But I think it's worthy to consider action, because I'd rather act too early than too late.
And he says the biggest motivation here is kids.
I see getting kids back to school, K through 12, as a goal. And the way to achieve that goal is through sacrifice. And that sacrifice is decreasing those things that we might want to do, but probably are risks and for transmission of the virus.
And he does also say, though, that, you know, state policy aside, it just will go a very long way. As you said, if people can just resist complacency, maintain vigilance with masks and social distancing and hand washing. And, you know, he has this great line. He says, so many people feel done with COVID, but that doesn't mean COVID is done with them. And just one last word from Mayor Walsh today. He had a very memorable line. He said something like, if COVID-19 were a football game, we're only at about halftime, which I must say made my heart sink, but I guess it's good perspective, right?
Yeah. And Carrie, Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Carrie, great to have you on today to put the back in perspective for us. I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's turn to your questions. What do you want to know now about the coronavirus? What's on your mind? What new information are you trying to process? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here to answer your questions today and talk more with us now about what's happening in Massachusetts overall, we have two local doctors who have joined us before. First is Dr. Cassandra Pierre, infectious disease physician and assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Pierre is also medical director of public health programs and associate hospital epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center. Welcome back, Dr. Pierre.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
And Dr. Shira Derone, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Derone, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be back.
So I think the two of you heard, I think, the conversation with Carrie Goldberg just now. We kind of talked about how to feel about these numbers and how much the change is. Are you worried? Has anything changed in your hospital in the past few days? Dr. Derone?
I tend to agree with Carrie that we need to be vigilant but not panicked about the slight rise in the percent positivity. It's still well within the range of, you know, Governor Baker's plan in terms of reopening. And what we need to do is not necessarily roll back reopening, but keep our foot on the gas in terms of that vigilance.
Dr. Pierre, is that how you feel about it too?
I agree that this uptick might just be a blip, and so it is important to put that into perspective. It's hard not to feel a little uneasy when we see massive surges happening in different places in the country, and I certainly think it makes sense to view this as an endurance sport, to not become too complacent, and to continue to monitor the numbers while we do the things that we need to do to keep them under control. Here at our hospital, we have not seen a blip. We haven't seen any changes in what we've been looking at very closely, which is COVID positivity. But we certainly have seen a bit of a rise in certain populations, the major one being younger people, so people under the age of 29.
So I'm going to go to the phones in a minute, but before I do, I know you both just heard Carrie Goldberg talking about the Massachusetts Medical Society kind of urging the state to consider a rollback of some parts of the reopening. How, you know, we do 3-day and 7-day average tracking on this data. How to know, I mean, that's lag indicators, right? That's information that's already come and we're interpreting it now. When the right time and if there's a right time to roll back, and how to not be too late on that as you're looking at numbers that have already happened.
Well, Dr. Jerome. I think one thing that's important to note is that we're not doing nothing in the last couple of days. What we know has changed is that the governor has enacted a much stricter travel order. And that's really a key response to what may be driving the slight uptick in numbers, which is the travelers from hotspots. So I think what we've seen over the last couple of months is that we're capable of doing reopening the right way, and that we can easily get derailed by the other parts of the country and people, you know, crossing the borders. And so this travel order, really, which is stronger than it's ever been before, has the potential to get that right under control.
And just to give our listeners a little more information on that, it was last Friday, Governor Baker, a few of the highlights. You have to fill out a traveler form on the website if you're coming into the state from any except eight accepted states. You have to quarantine for 14 days or present a negative COVID test from the previous 72 hours. And there can be a fine of $500 a day for failure to comply. I want to jump over to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to get some questions. We've got Chris from Hopkinton. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm curious to know what you all make of the article in the current Atlantic that talks about the fact that all of the cleaning and sanitizing of surfaces that we're doing is probably not as necessary as we think because the virus doesn't seem to be transferred that way.
So, Chris, let's
let go of that neuroticness a little bit, or?
Yeah. Let's ask Dr. Pierre about that. But we have one other question on a similar subject, so let me get them both in, and then we'll turn to Dr. Pierre. Thanks for that, Chris. We've also got Susan in Canton. Susan, go ahead.
Okay, well, my husband and I are both in our 70s. We've been very careful, and I'm just wondering if we have to continue to sanitize our mail, our groceries, our newspaper. It would be nice to be able to stop.
So right on that same vein, Dr. Pierre, do you know the article that Chris was asking about in The Atlantic?
Unfortunately, I have to admit I haven't read that article, but we certainly have been discussing the relative role of environmental contamination in COVID-19 infection. And I would have to agree that although we still think there probably is a small role to play, there have been figures that environmental contamination probably only accounts for 6% or less of COVID-19 infection. Now, that's not to say that it can never or does not happen. We also have other information that shows that COVID-19 can persist on surfaces, plastic, metal surfaces for long periods of time. And so while I think it's reasonable, especially when in common areas, to ensure that you are wiping down things that might have come into contact, especially with the respiratory secretions of others, in common spaces, I think that probably there's less of a role of wiping down things like your newspaper or, you know, maybe even your groceries. I know some places have allowed people to bring back their own grocery bags rather than the previous ban on that. But I think continued vigilance is important. I think the relative risk of these surfaces is probably been overstated earlier on in the epidemic. So, yes.
So let's stay with this, Dr. Durham, for just a minute longer, because I can give you a little bit, the both of you, the article. Derek Thompson wrote it. It's in The Atlantic. He is criticizing a term he calls hygiene theater, saying that kind of these constant deep cleans are misdirected. Here's a quote. Quote, COVID-19 has reawakened America's spirit of misdirected anxiety, inspiring businesses and families to obsess over risk reduction rituals that make us feel safer, but don't actually do much to reduce risk, even as more dangerous activities are still allowed, end quote. Now, that seems to be shooting further than what you're saying, Dr. Pierre. You're being, it sounds like to me, more cautious than that. But having had a chance to just put a little bit out there, since Chris asked about that article in particular, let me give you a chance to add on, Dr. Durone.
Well, I mean, I think he has a point, certainly. When we focus on that, we might lose focus on the things that are well proven to decrease transmission, the distancing, the masking. And so I think that it's It's a fair point. The CDC had put out a couple months ago, maybe now, its statement about how surfaces don't play a huge role in the transmission, that we really have to focus on that close personal contact. The breathing and coughing in each other's face is really going to be the primary mode of transmission. And right now, it's a statistics game. You know, if a very small percentage of people acquire the virus from a surface, and we have a very small percentage of people in our state with COVID-19, then, you know, you're really, your energy being placed towards sanitizing mail and grocery bags and things like that is probably not the place to put it.
All right, let's grab another question. Thanks to both of you on those two. 800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK. Alex is on the line from Lancaster. Alex, what's your question?
Hey, I was wondering if there's any merit to masks or any other products that, say, copper or other metals with antimicrobial features, I suppose.
Alex, you cut out there for a second. I think what you asked is masks or other products that are infused with copper or other antimicrobials. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, great. Let's go back to our panelists. Dr. Pierre.
So I'm not aware of any studies looking at masks that have been infused with copper, although we know that it is and it has antimicrobial properties, and it certainly has been used in many places, including in healthcare settings, in hospital rooms, to reduce the risk and the transmission of healthcare-acquired infections. However, presumably, and depending on how it's manufactured, it adds to weight. It might add to discomfort for the mask. And we actually know that what we have been using so far, at least for surgical grade masks, and in some instances for cloth masks, masks that are made with cotton, and some which have maybe even an interior of silk or other elements that might repel the virus through electrostatic charge, we have a really good recipe, I think, for things that work in terms of limiting exposure and limiting filtration of COVID. That being said, I certainly would be interested in innovations in mask use. We're always looking for bigger and better, but I'm not aware of masks that have been manufactured with metal properties as an added benefit. Also keeping in mind that copper surfaces have really just been utilized for the benefit of preventing the transmission of those healthcare acquired infections I mentioned from contact transmission. And we've already kind of decreased, we've already talked about how we needed to have a lower sense of risk for that in order to attune ourselves to the more important risk of respiratory spread. And so we certainly don't have any indication that it would be helpful for reducing respiratory-borne spread of SARS-CoV-2.
So thanks for that, Dr. Pierre. Dr. Daron, I'm going to turn to you. I have to do this one because it's been pretty high profile in the last 24 hours. President Trump yesterday retweeted out information on a video from Breitbart that showed a woman who identified herself as a doctor at a press conference saying that masks are unnecessary and that hydroxychloroquine, a drug that treats lupus and malaria, are quote unquote the cure. Twitter, Facebook, YouTube removed the video. So let's review. The medical consensus is that masks are necessary. And what about hydroxychloroquine?
The medical consensus currently is that the risks of hydroxychloroquine exceed the benefits, and it is no longer part of the treatment guidelines.
Okay, and where should people be turning for the most reliable and reputable information on the virus? Because stuff abounds out there.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Places like this, right here, right now, and places like, obviously, the medical literature, the CDC website, the WHO website, and the state health department websites.
Dr. Pierre, it's warm out there. We've been talking about beaches here on air the last couple of weeks. There's news out of the Cape today of some lifeguards down on the Cape testing positive for the virus. People want to be together in this heat. Just remind us basic guidance when you are gathering with other people.
Absolutely. This is actually a really important question to me because I know that Chatham is not unique. On my way home from work yesterday, I passed by through a block party and I slow to a crawl the way you do when you are evaluating an accident, because 40 to 50% of the people on either side were not wearing masks. But in answer to your question, yes, it is still part of our recommendation, even during the summer, even in the heat and our collective fatigue around social distancing, to continue to wear masks, surgical or cloth masks when out and about, to continue to physically distance 6 feet apart from those who you've not quarantined with. And to, of course, not go out if you are feeling ill and or if you have been exposed to someone who's been COVID positive and are awaiting your own test results. Those are all still the bedrocks of our infection prevention techniques, for which it is important really for all of us to continue to uphold, even though we feel like we need a reprieve. Again, this is an endurance sport, and any breaks in our barriers will unfortunately potentially lead to increased number of cases in those clusters.
And Dr. Duron, in our last half a minute or so, we talked at the top about the new travel restrictions from the governor. Lots of concern about college students soon coming in from all over the country. Are the restrictions we have in place, if they're practiced appropriately, enough to keep us from having a surge here in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, I hope so. The colleges in Massachusetts have really been working together and have been very strategic in their plans for reopening. All of them, as far as I know, have a testing plan, and so that should be able to overcome the logistics of the travel order. So they're partnering with the Broad, and there's a plan to do testing upon arrival with a quick turnaround. So they should be able to allow for those quarantines to happen and the testing to happen so that kids can get back to school.
All right, and that's Dr. Shira Duron of Tufts Medical Center and Dr. Cassandra Pierre of the Boston University School of Medicine. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Take care.
Looks like schools will have an extra 2 weeks to prepare for reopening this fall. Massachusetts Teachers Association says that the State Education Department reached the agreement with the MTA and two other teachers' unions yesterday. Teachers would use the extra 2 weeks to plan for all possible scenarios this fall, from a full return to the classroom to an all-remote learning plan and some sort of hybrid of the two. In a second, we're going to invite some folks who are grappling with these challenges to join us, but we want to open this up to you, too. What do you think? Have you heard the news? Is a two-week delay enough time to have schools really ready for fall learning? And I want to know, are you a parent and are you struggling with whether or not to send your child back to school in September? Does this additional delay, or it's not an additional delay, does this delay make you worry? Does it put you and your children in a bind? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So let's turn to our guests now. We're joined by Peter Light, the superintendent of the Acton-Boxborough Regional School District. Peter, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon, Tiziana. Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Francis Pina, a math teacher at Charlestown High School. Francis, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Peter, I'm going to start with you. We spoke with you back in May. You wrote this really thoughtful letter to your school community. And back then at the time, it seemed like the headline from that letter was, it's going to be okay. It's kind of not feeling like it's going to be okay, Peter.
That's a great lead in. You know, if we were in a press conference, I'd ask if there was a question there too, or just a lead to talk for a moment. You know, I think... you know, the lead was it's going to be okay. And I think we're in such a place of heightened anxiety right now with the number of unknowns that it feels often like it's not going to be okay. But I want to come back to I do think it's going to be okay. The bottom line, and you know, I can't speak for every school district, but I can certainly speak for ours. And I think many school districts are in the same place. We've been spending a lot of time planning for a variety of contingencies to make sure that when we do welcome students back in the fall, whatever that looks like, we're making sure it returns as a special place for them. And I think, you know, a message to our educators is, you know, we've been prioritizing all of our educators' health and safety just as we are our students. And that's been top of our mind. But we also really are focused on making sure that school is a special place, regardless of how we come back.
So, Francis, you heard Peter's answer there. When I heard the news this morning, I found myself wondering, okay, on the one hand, is this delay symbolic of the rock and hard place that this coming school year is stuck between? Or on the other hand, is this progress toward a viable approach to moving kids' learning forward this fall? We got a good perspective from Peter there. What about you? What do you think?
I would certainly agree that this is like that rock and a hard place type of scenario, and trying to accommodate for the fact of, I feel, with a lot of the time that we have taken going from last March to the end of this past school year, is that we haven't really been in a really good space of thinking about the innovation of the teaching practices, what is necessary for quality teaching, and making sure that we have the accessibility and equity issues accounted for. A lot of what's been happening has been a lot of discussions around logistics, and rightfully so, different, you know, teacher unions and educators and other stakeholders saying, hey, we haven't had a seat at the table when it comes to these plans. So front loading these 10 days gives us a chance to think about those teaching practices, and what would be the best ways of implement some innovation. But, you know, it may put us in a position to do something good, but we had an opportunity to do something great. And so I'm just looking at the bright side of that part. Like, let's do good with those 10 days.
Peter, I want to go to the calls in a second, but I want to pick up on something Francis just said about educators needing a seat at the table. As a superintendent, do you have eyes into, and do you feel like the right combination of people have had a seat at the table on planning?
Yeah, I think, you know, the planning that's gone into trying to reopen schools this fall is just extraordinarily complex. And, you know, the right number of getting everyone to the table is everyone, but that's just not always feasible. We've certainly taken great strides to make sure that we work very closely with our educators, our leaders in our association in particular. And, you know, we've surveyed our staff multiple times throughout the process. We continue to do that, making sure that staff voices make their way into the planning process. We reach out to groups of educators, depending on the topic that we're looking at. And I think it's just so important that people feel that they have a voice, you know, but I also recognize that, you know, until everyone somehow feels that their voice is heard, not everyone is going to feel like they have a voice. And that's a challenge we have to continue to work through.
All right, let's go to the phones here. 800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK to share your thoughts about how you're feeling about the start of the school year. Are you worried? Are you excited? Do you think it's going to happen the way you want it to? How would you like your kids to return, or how would you like to return yourself? We've got Max on the line from Weston. Max, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm a high school student, and I'm just wondering if the schools have said anything, if the state has said anything about how high school athletics might end up returning.
Thanks for the question, Max. Francis, I'll turn to you. Are you aware of how that's going to happen, or if it's going to happen in your school at Charlestown High School?
Yeah, I believe the superintendent is meeting with a consortium of different coaches, especially in thinking about fall sports before, I think, going into winter and spring sports. So I believe a lot of those discussions are ongoing. But if the look at professional sports is any indication, doesn't seem like it's looking that good from my perspective and as a teacher, but I know that that's an ongoing conversation with our local superintendent in Boston.
And Peter, what about you? Do you know any more on this at the state level?
Sure. You know, and, you know, first I'll say to Max, congratulations, because I know you have a new principal in Weston and he's just a tremendous individual. So congratulations. You're going to love him. But high school athletics is an ongoing conversation. MIAA, the board did vote for September 14th as the first official day. I think they wanted to let schools get open for students. We are waiting for additional guidance. I know there was some youth sports guidance provided by the governor's office. However, we're also waiting for MIAA and our State Department of Education to provide schools with additional guidance around what fall sports look like. We are hoping to receive that in the next, I believe, 1 to 2 weeks. So stay tuned for more on that.
All right, let's go back to the phones again. 800-423-8255. Charlie's on the line from Franklin. Charlie, what's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. As a parent with three kids in the Franklin Public Schools, we have felt tremendously supported by the school system, and I just want to thank the teachers, and I hope that they get all the time that they need. And if 2 weeks is all we get, then that'll have to be it. But additionally, I'd like to call on employers to be really as generous as they can. I know it's a hard time for everybody, but if we can get the whole system working together, then parents don't have to have the anxiety level they might have in waiting for the kids to start officially again.
Thanks for that call, Charlie. And in addition to the good feelings and the gratitude that Charlie expressed there, Francis, he raises a tricky issue, which is, from a very practical standpoint, for a lot of families, school is not only the place that educates children, but it also allows people to go to work because their children are in care during that time. They've been out for a long time. If the school day is delayed, the start of school is delayed further, that can put real hardship, especially on families who have to work. They're essential workers. Maybe they can't work at home. How should we be thinking about and balancing that as we get ready to go back to school, Francis?
Yeah, I think that's a very challenging thing to balance because it has to be done from an equity lens of, you know, working in a high school, depending on the needs of the student, maybe they have an IEP or severe disabilities, they may need someone to be right there with them. They can't be left alone. But you know, I would say probably the majority of our high school students may be able to be left alone to participate in remote learning if we are fully remote, so parents can potentially go back to work. I see that as a bigger challenge for the elementary school level, and it's also a very bigger challenge, or a different challenge rather, on the elementary school level to even be back in school when we think about self-regulation and manipulatives and sharing objects. A lot of the learning that you do in elementary schools in the younger ages is hands-on. So I think we need to really be thinking about how are we going to use a lot of these community spaces? How can we have been doing a little bit more collaboration, you know, with local with community centers, with even in Boston, with colleges, with universities that are not having students back? How can we do this in a way that is the neighborhood, like really supporting the neighborhood? So that way we can really be creative about that aspect of the childcare aspect. I mean, schools do supply that, and that may not be my primary job function, but it is a benefit that I do have, and I do care for all my students and do care for their health when I am there with them.
I want to play some sound for the two of you. WBUR spoke with Kevin Murray, Executive Director of the Mass Advocates for Children, about this delay. Murray said it could be a big positive as long as the time is used well.
I think any time that can be put into thinking more creatively about how remote education happens, what is the interaction between remote and in-person education, if there is to be in-person education? And perhaps for me, for Mac, the most important thing, how are we going to engage with families about this process?
So, Peter, I feel such a tension in listening to that. That makes absolute sense. And it makes sense what Francis was just saying, too. There's this other voice that says, we've been doing distance education since last March. There are a lot of complexities here, but many of the basics that we need to prepare for, we've known about. Masks, social distancing, reducing personal contact in tight spaces among students, etc. Why 10 more days? Haven't we known? Shouldn't we have been planning for, you know, as Kevin Murray says here, all along for this?
Tiziana, I think that's a great question. You know, I'm going to go just a little off topic first, because I think you hinted at this with the last caller with Charlie, but, you know, we need to take a balanced assessment of risk. You know, there's absolutely no doubt in anyone's mind that health and safety need to be our top priorities, particularly with the pandemic going on. But there are definitely other risks that we need to be thinking about in all of our planning. And, you know, there's a new project that just got launched called the Parabola Project, and they really outline it well. But, you know, we have additional risks like loss of learning, food insecurity. We just talked about parental employment, and, you know, that's as much of a risk for our students as it is just for their parents. The social emotional impact of schools being closed, and the lack of access to some of the essential services for children as well. And I think, you know, schools play a vital role in all of those. And we have been planning all along for the three things. Amid all of the uncertainty about what leads to the spread of the virus is a real sense of certainty about what can be done to prevent the spread of the virus. And schools have been planning very dutifully to make sure that people understand the need for masks, and that masks really need to be worn by our students when they return to school, because that's a huge protective factor. The idea of maintaining appropriate distance within our classrooms is also an area that schools certainly have been planning for. And then really thinking about all of our practices around hygiene to make sure that, you know, students are regularly washing hands, our educators are washing hands and sanitizing hands. Those are really three critical practices that are going to help protect people and mitigate risk as we return. I think the 10 days is just such an important piece, because for all of the complexity of the planning process, when you bring a plan to fruition, people have a lot of questions. And I think we need to make sure coming back that, you know, not only do our educators know what the plan is, but they have an opportunity to ask questions, process that. It's one thing when a district makes a plan at the district level, but then it has to be implemented at schools where each school is just a little bit different from the other school. And there's a lot of planning that goes into making sure everyone is first and foremost safe. But then we have to think about the learning that was unfinished from the previous year and what needs to be done as we move forward. We need to think about the social emotional needs of students and what strategies we have in place in classrooms. And we really need to make sure our educators feel very supported in implementing a remote learning program in the fall that is far more robust and substantial than what we were able to do in the spring. We were in crisis education mode last spring, and we still will be in crisis education mode, but we have had an opportunity to think forward at this point.
Peter, I appreciate that, and I want to build on that. We have just a little bit of time yet left. So, Francis, I'm going to turn to you for this one, because there's also a tremendous urgency around students who were experiencing structural disadvantages in their education, whether that be through access to technology, quality of the school's home environment that's conducive to learning, trauma, now also experiencing disproportionate impact from the virus itself, and now this disrupted learning environment with still a great deal of uncertainty. How do we go forward intentionally, right, not in crisis learning anymore, in a way that doesn't leave some of our young people behind?
Yes, I mean, you said the key word for me right there is intentional. I think about across our district, really even across our state, we have different socioeconomics that come into play, not only just race, but as well as like income level. So I know the American Institute of Research released a study that talked about the difference in, you know, low income districts tended to spend a lot of time with remote learning reviewing content, and more middle and high income districts were teaching new content. So we have to really think about, like, for each of these districts, depending on the context that you are in, how are we starting this year intentionally, you know, really building relationships with our students and with staff. So during that 2 weeks, I know, you know, at my school level, we're going to be meeting not only to really think about content and think about us as a small learning community, but how are we building relationships in the community with ourselves and in classrooms. So that way, when we, you know, begin, you know, whether it's remote or hybrid, you know, I'm hoping for remote, but that's a separate thing, that we can leverage those relationships that we are building with students. And I know some schools may have to think about, you know, the looping aspect. You know, will teachers potentially be teaching new content that they haven't taught before, because mm-hmm. they may loop up with students to maintain some of those relationships. So I think like that type of intention and conversation and also, you know, intentionally thinking about, okay, there is this piece, like during COVID, if you would have told me, you know, all the things with, you know, Black Lives Matter and stuff coming up would have overtaken mm-hmm. the COVID discussion, I would have been surprised. So that also plays a role and needs to be talked about and addressed.
And that's Frances Pina, a math teacher at Charlestown High School. Frances, I appreciate you taking time out to join us today.
Oh, thank you. It was a blast.
And we've also had Peter Light, superintendent of the Acton Boxborough Regional School District. Peter, it was great to have you back. Thanks for your time, too.
Thanks so much and have a great day.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
You must understand that there are forces that want to take us back to another period. But you must never, ever give up or give in. You must keep the faith and keep your eyes on the prize. That is your calling. That is your mission. That is your moral obligation. That is your mandate. Get out there and do it. Get in the way.
Those were the words of John Lewis, ringing out in the Capitol Rotunda yesterday. As his body lay in state, the first Black lawmaker to do so, Lewis leaves a profound impact on American history and a profound impact on his former colleague, Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. Congresswoman Pressley, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you, Tiziana.
You know, it's kind of one of the ironies of life that we often don't get the luxury of really reflecting on someone who means so much to us until they've passed. You know, there is the congressman yesterday, his casket draped in an American flag in the middle of that room, making history even in death, his entire adult life important to our modern history. It feels insufficient to ask you how that moment felt to you yesterday, but I think I got to just start there.
No, I feel inordinately blessed to have walked this earth and the halls of Congress at the same time as Congressman John Lewis, to have broken bread with him, to have prayed with him, to have danced with him. I feel inordinately blessed and simultaneously robbed at the same time, because although we had him for 80 glorious years, and might I add, defying the average life expectancy of Black men by many, many years. But it just seems that 80 years, when there's that much goodness, that much grace, that much conviction, that much humility, is just not enough. And in fact, it might just be a testament to the fact that making good trouble is good for the soul, is good for the body, and might even be the key to longevity. And because he had defied every odd, you know, this spiritual prodigy, someone who got the call to serve God so early in life, who spoke often of preaching to the chickens as a young boy, went on to then command the respect and the attention of presidents, ambassadors, and thought leaders, and to be the conscience of not only the Congress, but I think our nation. It was very emotional yesterday. Members of the Congressional Black Caucus stood in a circle at the end around his casket. And we're still grieving the loss of Elijah Cummings. And it was just very hard. I touched his casket. I wept openly. I was carrying my mail-in ballot with me inside the program book. And I just said over and over again, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It is especially hard to have lost him at a moment of renewed reckoning on racial justice, at a time of such unprecedented hurt, to lose his moral clarity and voice, his decency at this moment. It is especially painful.
Why did you bring your mail-in ballot with you yesterday?
Well, because I'm a beneficiary of his activism, of the blood that he shed on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And I could not cast that ballot were it not for Congressman John Lewis and Reverend C.T. Anderson. And I want to bring into this conversation local civil rights shero, Mimi Jones, who just passed away as well. I think, women are often the hidden figures in this movement. But, you know, John Lewis was an original architect of the Black Lives Matter movement. That march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge was in protest to police brutality. And so we find ourselves in the midst of these old fights, but I'm going to keep the hope that this is a new day, because John Lewis never lost the hope. I found just yesterday his memoir, Walking with the Wind, that he had autographed for me, and he just wrote on the inside, as he said so often, keep the faith, never give up.
Your comment about Black Lives Matter made me think, he spoke to Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty in 2013, and I'm going to play some sound for you. He said this about how he saw the activism of the current young generation.
I'm deeply concerned that the present generation failed to grasp what happened. That's why I think it's so important for young people and those not so young to understand that there's a role for them to play. I have this feeling that people are just too quiet. They need to make some noise.
So that was August of 2013, and 1 year later, August of 2014, young people and activists took to the streets in Ferguson, Missouri, after a jury didn't indict police officers in the killing of Michael Brown, and it certainly has not been quiet since then. How much is his example of activism what we're seeing in the noisiness of these years and these days?
Oh, certainly. Again, they gave us... Eric Holder refers to Dr. King and John Lewis and Reverend C.T. and Andrew Young and Abernathy as our other founding fathers, because theirs was the fight of an inclusive democracy. And they gave us the blueprint to organize, to mobilize, to legislate. And that is exactly why, for those that might be offering their well-meaning platitudes about John Lewis and seek to rewrite history, John Lewis was disruptive. John Lewis was agitating the status quo. John Lewis was seeking law change. And so that's why I find it so disingenuous when I have colleagues across the aisle that are offering these condolence platitudes. And meanwhile, Mitch McConnell has sitting on his desk for 200 days, H.R. 4, which should be renamed the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. So you cannot utter John Lewis's name when you are legislating or obstructing in such a way that you seek to undermine our very democracy to ensure free and fair elections, which is the very thing for which John Lewis shed blood on that bridge. And so, you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tiziana.
No, it's okay. We're almost out of time. And so I think I'm just going to let you finish that thought, because we've only got about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, my final image of him is I did go to Alabama with my family when he did that final walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. He was, you know, diminutive, frail, but he was supported by community as he gave an address on that bridge. And he never stopped fighting. He never stopped fighting to realize justice and equity. And we must never stop fighting. That is the lesson of John Lewis. Keep the faith.
Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, I really appreciate you joining us today. Thanks.
Thank you.